Get out of this place, man. CKDU's been on the air for 25 years and we ain't going nowhere.
Can't stop us tonight.
Hey, folks. This is CKDU 88.1 FM. This is Society as a Prison. I had talked to Warren Goldner because he's written a lot about the crisis from a Marxist or a communist perspective. And he's come from a different perspective than even some Marxists. He emphasizes imperialism and as a form of primitive accumulation. And he'll talk a lot more about that than I'm going to. He's written extensively about the working class in North America and Asia, specifically in South Korea. And like I said, I did this interview about when the economic crisis was more on my mind. And it's still pertinent. I don't know if you read the papers, they're constantly talking about the economy still. I guess they're always talking about the economy. And I'm going to have Lauren talk about the economy as well. Hopefully folks will enjoy this. This is about 20 minutes. It's only the first half because, he talks about dense stuff. So I thought it might be easiest if I broke it in two. And here we go.
If we look at so-called advanced capitalist societies like the U.S. or much of Western Europe, I would call them advanced, above all, in decay. We find in the last 50 years that the financial and real estate parts of those economies have grown tremendously relative to, let's say, the total social product, or what bourgeois economists, I should say economists because there is only bourgeois economics, what economists call GDP or GNP. What that means is it opens up, as we saw in the last 6 or 7 years, and above all in the last 2 or 3 years, a tremendous opening for speculative activity. U.S. Subprime mortgage bubble is just an extreme example of where huge amounts of money were made simply by flipping houses, selling houses to people who had no hope of keeping up with the mortgage, and all the other kinds of fraud that have come to light in the last couple of years. So that's a first approximation of fictitious capital. Speculative claims on the total profit or total surplus of society that have no correspondence to any actual wealth created by what we could call real economic activity. That viewpoint by itself could be articulated from many different points of view, but the important thing from a Marxist point of view is that fictitious capital originates in production. Capitalism develops the productive forces, develops productivity, but it does it in a very anarchic way. There is no central guiding hand or intelligence in capitalism. As a result of this, the general gains in productivity. Let's take the example of the telecommunications revolution and the transport revolution. The cost of moving goods around the world became radically cheaper. This cheapening is not reflected immediately in the way the sort of what we call the book value of capitalist firms. And so over time, a discrepancy develops between the profit claimed or demanded by individual firms in order to have an adequate rate of profit and the actual value today of producing their assets, the factories, the machinery, and so on, not to mention the cost of reproducing the labor they employ. And so, once again, capitalist crisis is a form of retroactive planning, if you will, in which the inflated fictitious values that mix with these other kinds of speculation that I mentioned announcing remarkable rates of return on investment, pulling in naive or even not so naive people who think that they're getting a special deal, paying off the initial participants with the money put up by new participants, and then sort of leaving town literally or figuratively when it becomes impossible to maintain the chain of payments. That pattern has characterized capitalist crisis, financial aspects of capitalist crisis going back well into the early 19th century. So what happened in the 90s was that capitalism stumbled onto what is called securitized finance. Securitized finance means basically taking different kinds of these paper claims on profit that I mentioned earlier, let's say mortgages, subprime mortgages. Somebody makes 100 subprime mortgages, and those mortgages are planned to produce a certain income stream. Some of them will end in bankruptcy, but overall, everything will work out profitably. Somebody takes those 100 mortgages and packages them into a new form of capitalist paper, some kind of certificate that itself produces an income stream based on the 100 mortgages underlying it. And this game can go on indefinitely as each successive investor takes previous, this is called gearing in the parlance of the financial markets, building up a whole pyramid of capitalist streams of income based on underlying streams of income almost ad infinitum. When you get down to rock bottom, it's, let's say, 100 very unsound subprime mortgages. So that leveraging or that use of securitized finance after a brief recession of 2001 really took off. And with the kind of creative accounting that has also come to light, it became possible for banks to get deeply involved in this. This all is fine as long as everything is expanding and the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank and Bank of England, this, most of all, sort of subsidized, underwrote this whole process whenever there was any kind of slowdown or danger posed by some local bankruptcy. They stepped right in, lowered interest rates, expanded money, made credit easily available to continue the whole game. This was known in the U.S. Financial markets as the Greenspan put, that the Fed would always come to the rescue, and a whole generation of people working in the financial sphere who'd never known even a mild contraction just assumed that this could go on forever, housing prices would rise forever. No, all the kinds of superstitions that emerge in a sort of short-sighted capitalist mentality in a typical business cycle. Now we're riding the escalator down and seeing a whole new reality. Working class rebellion that was taking place in those years. And problem because the U.S. dollar by that time becomes a very important international reserve currency. Inflation starts to take off in the United States and is depreciating those holdings abroad. We see the same kinds of things happening right now with China, above all. China has $1 to $2 trillion in its central bank from two decades of trade with the United States, and it's very concerned about the reflation that the U.S. government undertook in the last year to save the banking system and the financial system from complete collapse. So this is really an old story, but the proportions have grown tremendously since the 1960s. The important role it plays in primitive accumulation and in maintaining the stability of the system is that we can see this, for example, in loans to the Third World, starting in the 60s and above all in the 70s, U.S. and European banks began lending very large sums to, above all, Latin America and, to a lesser extent, to the former so-called socialist bloc. These borrowing countries had to pay or make regular payments on those loans, and to do that, they had to export goods to the United States or Western Europe. And generally, I would say that there was sort of an increment of a free lunch in those exports. The amount of labor required to produce them, the raw materials used in them, or often they were simply raw materials, was not compensated by the price those goods commanded on the world market. And therefore, over time, lending powers, imperialist center, the U.S. and Western Europe, were sort of subsidized by a certain amount of free inputs coming from third world countries. In addition to that, these countries were also exporting people to work in the United States and in Western Europe, so that labor power, whose costs were not paid for by the capitalist class in the U.S. or Europe, came into those economies, worked there, made generally low wages, generally returned at some point to their countries. So they also added an element of more or less unpaid wealth to the lending economies of the center. So that's a relatively straightforward and simple example of how this fictitious capital affects the real economy. We can go on to talk about pollution and the overall environmental crisis. This results from the way in which capitalism does not consider damage to the environment as part of the cost of production. Pollution that results from a factory or from mining contributing to the warming of the global atmosphere, these are social costs that have to be taken into account in figuring the whole impact of productive activity on the world. A strip mine in West Virginia doesn't consider the environmental impact of its mining as part of its cost. And to date, by and large, society simply bears those costs in other forms. So that's another way in which the skewed character, the impact of fictitious values are propped up by free costs, free raw materials from underdeveloped countries, free labor power, free use of the environment without, to use a Marxist term, reproducing it, without putting back in the nature that was used up or damaged by production. My basic prediction is that, as we saw just in the last couple of weeks, world production is continuing to fall at a very rapid rate. The capitalist press seizes on even a slowing of the rate of decline as a sign of green shoots and hope that the whole situation is bottoming out. But the most recent take, even by capitalist investors, is that things are not bottoming out. So the basic scenario for the short to medium term, in my opinion, is deflation and contraction. And at that point, I think it will become a highly charged political question, what happens next. If we see some signs of resistance in the working class in some countries or in the broader population, the riots that have taken place in Eastern Europe or in Greece, boss napping, as it's called, in France, factory occupations in Britain, the next step, I think, with the failure of the normal Keynesian reflation will have to be something more extreme. And at that point, particularly if there is any kind of mass resistance by working class and, let's say more broadly, ordinary working people to the kind of austerity that's coming down, some authoritarian alternatives will emerge. I mean, let's just consider the crisis of the states in the United States right now. Something like 30 states are effectively bankrupt, so that California, for example, which I think it's, if it were an independent country, it would be the eighth or ninth largest economy in the world, is on the verge of closing hospitals, libraries, public parks, virtually every kind of service you can imagine as a way of dealing with this. And the cost to ordinary people is just becoming palpable. So I think the situation where the whole tolerance for the reflation that the capitalist states have attempted in the last year or 18 months, the point where that is going to snap is not far off. And at that point, any number of other alternatives are possible. I think the capitalists themselves are quite at sea in terms of what to do, because nothing in their ideology of recent decades prepares them to deal with this kind of crisis, which they have always assumed was ancient history and something that could always be managed in the last instance by government and central bank intervention.
Hey folks, you're listening to CKDU 88.1 FM.